It's direct, definitely related to the Gospels, but we're actually not going to work out of the harmony. I'm going to give you a lot of background information. This will be similar to the message I gave on Remez, where we jump back and forth through a lot of different material to give you an overall comprehension of some of the things that are going on in the background. We've been kind of leading up to this the last 2 days' classes, and now I want to tie a lot of loose ends together, as well as lay a foundation for what we'll be covering through the rest of the material. Yesterday, where we left off was with Jesus Christ settling in Capernaum, and we talked about why Jesus chose Capernaum specifically as a place to center his ministry there, and talked about how it was located where the Via Maris was, the Way of the Sea, this major highway that ran just right outside Capernaum, and how that helped magnify the impact of his ministry, word of his healings, word of his teachings, and so on. And that's why we see phrases like word of him spread throughout the region of Galilee. And we also see people coming from fairly far away to hear his teaching. And that's because it was spread by word of mouth along this international highway there. So today I want to do kind of the same thing and expand it out a little bit from just Capernaum to Galilee and talk about the cast of characters that we encounter there, some of the historical background that plays into what we read about in the gospel, some of the who are the different players in that area that Jesus encounters, and what is their background, what do they believe? How does that affect what we read about there in the Gospels? This question came up yesterday as to the prophecies of Jesus beginning his ministry in Galilee. You'll want to take a lot of notes here on this, because this is important stuff and helps fill in a lot of pieces of some of the things we may find puzzling. But here is one of the famous prophecies here of Jesus settling and beginning his ministry in Galilee. So Matthew 4 and verse 13 through 16, and it is quoting from Isaiah 9, 1 and 2. And it says, "And leaving Nazareth, he, Jesus, came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the Sea of Galilee, in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, that Via Maris that we talked about yesterday, so that's actually mentioned in the prophecy, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and upon those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned." So it was foretold about 8 centuries earlier that the Messiah would appear in Galilee. And I've touched on this briefly before, but Nazareth, which is in the tribal allotment of Zebulun, right up here, and Capernaum, right up here on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, is in the tribal allotment of Naphtali. So here, this was foretold, again, about 8 centuries before, that Jesus would appear there and be working in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, and in overall Galilee of the Gentiles, this area here around the Sea of Galilee. So not just Galilee was foretold, but the specific areas in which Jesus Christ would conduct his ministry were foretold centuries before. So let's look then at this area more closely. We will be referring to your maps here on the back cover of your Harmony and the one 3 pages before that quite a bit today. So you may want to have those handy. So this is the first map we'll look at. This is the one that is on the back cover of your Harmony. And it's 4 times like this that I provided those maps for you, so you can see where these places relate to each other. We're going to be referring to this a lot today, so keep it handy there. Galilee, of course, is in the far north of what is today Israel. Most of Israel is down below that. It's not at all far from the modern countries of Lebanon and Syria, of which Israel has had wars, fought wars with Lebanon and Syria, and is on a fairly regular basis having terrorist infiltration and so on from Hezbollah, which is a terror group in Israel, and things like that. So this area is in the news a fair amount there. The other area that you hear a lot about on the news, just FYI, is Gaza down here where it says Ascalon on the map. It's the Gaza Strip or Gaza, and that's where they're firing mortars and rockets into southern Israel fairly frequent basis there. So two areas of terror attacks basically down here. And then up here, this is where Hezbollah has literally tens of thousands of missiles aimed at Israel. So in the next war, this is definitely going to be a very, very much of a hot spot. I say the next war because it's a pretty foregone conclusion. It's going to be one. It's just a matter of when. So this is from Jerusalem, which we've talked about quite a bit, roughly 75 miles as the crow flies from there to Galilee. Walking somewhere 90 to 100 miles, something like that, takes about 4 or 5 day walk, depending on your fitness level. An adult male could do it in about 4 days, women and children considerably longer. So about 4 or 5 days trip back and forth between the two. Again, roughly 75 miles as a crow flies, 100 miles walking in round terms. So let's look again at the closer map. This is the one several pages from the back inside your map. And this is a closer area of the Galilee region. Give an idea of the scale of this. Approximately 30 miles east and west and north and south is the region called Galilee there. So the whole area of Galilee could fit within the greater Cincinnati area quite easily. Could fit easily into the area of a lot of our major cities here. We see on this map a number of the places. We've talked about several of them so far. We've talked about Capernaum, Bethsaida, Chorazin, the main area of Christ's ministry, Gennesaret, another one, Magdala, which is Mary Magdalene, comes from Magdala. That's where Magdalene comes from. Cana, we've talked about, Nazareth over here where Jesus grows up. So this gives us an overview of that area. There are many other towns and villages as well. Some are known, some are not known. But this is a good overview of what is taking place. Again, the Sea of Galilee, approximately 8 miles east and west, approximately 12 miles north and south there. So it's about the size of some of our larger reservoirs here. It's not really a sea as we would think of the Mediterranean Sea or Gulf of Mexico or something like that. It's about the size of some of our largest reservoirs here in the United States. So Galilee region gets its name from the Sea of Galilee here. It's called several other names in the Bible. It's called, one is the Sea of Chinnereth, which means harp in Hebrew, because it's shaped like an ancient harp, the overall shape of it, something like that. It is a freshwater lake fed primarily by the Jordan River coming in from the north, as well as it being down in a bowl at a lower elevation. All the rainfall from that area drains down. It's about 700 feet below sea level and more than 200 feet deep in some places, which is extraordinarily deep for a lake. Again, this is a volcanic area, a lot of earthquakes in that area. It's along some of the tectonic plates in that area called the Jordan Rift Valley. That's why it's a very deep, very steep valley there. If the weather is clear, the Sea of Galilee is so small you can see virtually the entire lake. You can see all the shoreline. And that's why at times Jesus sits off in a boat to sail across the lake to get away from the crowds. And when he gets to the other side, the crowds are there waiting for him because they can see. On a good clear day, they can see where the boat is heading and walk around the shore and get over there. So That's what's going on when we see these crowds following Jesus. They can tell he's on a boat and see where the boat is going and get there as well. So it's quite difficult for him when he wants to get away to be able to do so because of that. A little bit about the climate of the area. It's quite mild, wintertime highs in the 50s, summertime highs in the 80s generally. Gets about 20 inches of rain a year, which is about probably about a third what falls here in the Cincinnati area. The soil is quite fertile. It grows just about everything there. Wheat, barley, figs, grapes, olives, and so on. Because of the fertility of the land, people had a pretty good living there, pretty good standard of living. They weren't dirt poor peasants living hand to mouth. Average person would have been what we would call middle class today. They had a pretty good living, nice climate, fertile soil, good for agriculture, for animals, and so on. Not many people were very wealthy, but on the whole, it was a pretty good place to make a living there. And that probably also contributes some to Jesus settling there. So now let's talk about the history a bit. I touched on this some earlier, but to understand some of the interplay that is going taking place in Christ's ministry, we need to understand the history of this region and its peoples and the culture in that area. To recap some of Israel's history, this was part of the northern 10 tribes who were invaded and carried away into captivity by the Assyrians, 721 to 718 BC. They're taken away into captivity by the Assyrians and became known as the Lost Ten Tribes. The southern kingdom of Judah didn't learn the lesson from the backsliding of Israel, and they continued on for not much more than a century later after the fall of the Assyrian Empire. And then in 586, Jerusalem is captured by the Babylonians. The temple is destroyed. The city of Jerusalem is destroyed. And most of its people are exiled to Babylon. And that is why to this day you find scattered groups of Jews all over what is today Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, across North Africa, and so on. They were scattered then, came back to some of them came back. Then there was another dispersion after the Roman Wars there in 70 AD and then 132 to 135 AD. So here's what that looks like on a map. Presumably you have covered this, or you know, they're taken away from this area, scattered first the northern 10 tribes into Assyria, and then the Jews over to Babylon. The Jews, some of them, a fairly small percentage of them return. Most of them stay there in Babylon, because they've got a good life there in Babylon. The northern 10 tribes disappear from history. We know that they migrated and formed the backbone of our nation, the modern Israelite nations, Britain, and so on. So after the Babylonian Empire is defeated by the Medo-Persian Empire, Cyrus the Great allows the Jews to return and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple, which we find in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And you may remember, and this is illustrated here, they're working with their tools in one hand and their weapons in another because the hostility of the people there to having Jerusalem rebuilt. And the people realize that they have been taken into captivity because of their sins, Sabbath breaking and idolatry predominantly. So they are determined not to repeat their mistakes. And this also impacts a lot of what we read about in the Gospels, because the Jews who return from Babylon, again, not all of them do, most of them stay in Babylon. So they return from Babylon, they rebuild Jerusalem and the temple, and they are very religiously conservative. They don't want to repeat the mistakes of their ancestors and have the same thing happen to them that happened to their ancestors, being defeated, being taken away into captivity, losing everything that they had. And this is where and how the very the conflicts that we see between Jesus Christ and the Pharisees over the Sabbath originate. Because they know they were taken into captivity for Sabbath breaking. Ezekiel talks about that. I don't remember off the top of my head which chapter. But he says specifically they were taken into captivity for breaking the Sabbath and for idolatry. So they know that. They've got that in writing there. So they establish this elaborate set of rules over what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath. And I know Stephen and Danielle have lived in Israel, and they see this. If you drive your car through certain parts of Jerusalem on the Sabbath, you can get your car stoned because you shouldn't be driving a car on the Sabbath, in their opinion. But those rules became incredibly picky. And just to illustrate a few of them, you could not spit on the ground on the Sabbath because that could disturb the soil, and that was viewed as a type of plowing. And I'm serious about this. If your house caught on fire on the Sabbath, you couldn't grab all the clothes out of your closet and run outside to save them, but you could put on as many layers of clothes as you could and walk out. You just couldn't carry them because that's carrying a burden. But if you put on 10 layers and you wear them out, that is okay. This is how picky some of the rules were. If you were a tailor, for instance, you could not, as a tailor would in that day, stick a needle or two in his garment and walk on the Sabbath with that, because that is carrying an unnecessary burden on the Sabbath, two needles stuck in your clothing. The rabbis debated whether if a man had a wooden leg, whether it was legal to wear his wooden leg on the Sabbath. Is that carrying an unnecessary burden? You couldn't heal on the Sabbath, and this is where Jesus runs into a lot of conflict with the Pharisees, because their rules were you couldn't heal on the Sabbath. That should be done on other days of the week. You could bandage somebody's wounds if they were in danger of bleeding to death, but you could not put olive oil or some antiseptic or disinfectant on a wound on the Sabbath because that was healing. So you could save the person's life by preventing them from bleeding to death, but you could not heal them. So this was one of their rules, and we see continual conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees over healing on the Sabbath, and this is why. He wasn't breaking the Sabbath, but he was breaking their stupid rules about the Sabbath that made the Sabbath a burden instead of the delight that God intends the Sabbath day to be. So this is the background, the mindset of a lot of these Jews who have returned from Babylon there. And it leads to conflict. Their motivations are right, don't get me wrong. They are deeply religious. They are deeply motivated to obey God. But they have just lost any sense of balance and understanding of what God's real intent and purpose was for the Sabbath day. Also, when we get to the time of the Gospels, we've touched on this already, Jerusalem has become the religious center of the nation with the temple constructed by Herod the Great. It's also the center for the priesthood and for the scribes and the Sadducees. Those are the people Jesus generally runs into conflict with in Jerusalem. The Pharisees are scattered more out in the countryside as a general rule. They're not concentrated in Jerusalem like the priesthood and the scribes and the Sadducees. So there is a direct opposition to Jesus when he goes to Jerusalem, as we talked about with overturning the money changers' tables and driving the animals out, because it's a threat to their power, to their position, because they are part of this Jerusalem religious establishment that controls all of that. Let's talk about another area. We've touched on that this week, and that is the area of Samaria. Went through some of that background. Samaria's here's Judea, here's Jerusalem, the area of Samaria up here, named after the ancient capital city of the northern 10 tribes, which was Samaria, right here. I've been to the ruins of that city. One of the coins that I passed around the other day was from Samaria, there when it was a Roman city. So this again was the capital of the northern ten tribes, where it was besieged for several years and its inhabitants taken away. And then as we talk about who are the Samaritan peoples, well, when the Assyrians took the Israelites away, they brought in pagan Gentiles from other parts of the Assyrian Empire and replaced them, put them in the land. Why did the Assyrians do that? Well, they did that to, frankly, to prevent anybody from rebelling again, because they separated people from their land, took them away from their roots, to lessen any incentive they would have to rebel and stage an uprising again. And it was very effective. It worked. So it just removed people from their land, their roots. It gave them less motivation to fight for anything, because they have no more land to fight from. Their land is hundreds of miles away now. So it just disincentivizes any reason for rebelling against the Assyrians then. So again, the conflict between the Samaritans and the Jews, they hate each other because the Jews view the Samaritans as imposters, as pagans, which they are. And they have also mixed the elements of the true worship of God. They had the Samaritan Pentateuch that we talked about yesterday. Those are the only five books of the Bible that they believed in. So the Jews viewed them as imposters. And the Samaritans, meanwhile, disliked the Jews because they were so self-righteous and arrogant, and they thought they were the only people that God could ever use or work with. So again, if you were a Jew walking through Samaria, you could be beaten up and killed. If you were a Samaritan walking through Judea, you could be beaten up and killed. So this gives us some more understanding of the parable of the Good Samaritan, which we'll touch on when we get to that. Jesus took somebody who was absolutely despised in that Jewish society and makes him the hero of the story, the Good Samaritan. There, that's kind of the background for that. We do see Jesus occasionally, I think I mentioned this earlier, two main routes between Jerusalem and there. One is along the Jordan River, where it's flat and level, and you have a regular water source there, the Jordan River. And then the other route, which follows along the mountain ridges, called the Ridge Route, going up, kind of winding path up that way. So Jews normally tried to avoid going through Samaria because of the antagonism there. Jesus does from time to time, but he's traveling with a group of probably 10, 15, 20 people, his disciples there. So there's safety in numbers there, but he would not in all likelihood have ever gone there alone by himself because of the physical danger of that. Okay, now let's look at another region over here called Decapolis, over on the east side of the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee. Decapolis in Greek, deca means 10, polis means city or city, so it means 10 cities. What's going on in here? It's referred to in the Gospels a few times, or some of the cities are. But not much is said about it. But it is an important and influential area here. And when we understand its background, that also clears up some puzzling things that we read about in the Gospels. The culture of the Decapolis was very, very different from Judea, from Galilee, from Samaria, because of its history. You may have heard of a few of the cities there. Scythopolis is one of them today. It's called Bethshan. If you ever go to Israel, it's a very nicely preserved Roman city from this period. See some of the best Roman ruins in Israel there. Some other places like Philadelphia over here, that's actually Amman, Jordan, the capital of the Kingdom of Jordan today. Gadara, Gergesa, some of these other cities over here. So how did this area get the Greek name Decapolis? Here, too, we need a lesson in history. We've covered a fair amount of history here. We've talked about the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. Which great Gentile empire came next after Assyria, Babylon, Persia? What's next? Greece. Greece under who? Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great, 333 BC, he founds these Decapolis cities, the 10 cities of the Decapolis, these city-states over in here. Incidentally, they're not all shown on the map, but they are over here. I've been to visit several of them there. Alexander was known for being a great military leader, but he was also a missionary. A missionary. Who's a missionary? It's somebody who spreads religious ideas. He wanted the whole world to adopt the Greek culture, and known as Hellenism. Everybody say Hellenism. Hellenism, Hellenism. That's a word you should remember. It's very important. Add it to your vocabulary. We see this referred to a few times in the Gospels. There's a group of people called Hellenists that we occasionally encounter. And these are basically people who have adopted Greek culture, Greek thinking, Greek ideas and practices, in some cases even Greek religion, with all their gods and goddesses, Zeus and Athena and all of this. Yes, Emily? Hellenism, Greek thought and culture. It's what they think. It's what they believe. It's how they act. It's what they build. It's everything they do, Hellenism. So the Hellenists are another group that we see mentioned a few times in the New Testament. Not so much in the Gospels, but when Paul travels, when he goes up through Asia Minor, when he goes over to Greece, he's encountering this Greek culture right and left. And this is all the pagan temples, the gods, the goddesses, the people who want to bow down and worship him, thinking he's a god and all this kind of thing. And the influence it has had on the world of that day and on our modern culture is astounding. And this is where, frankly, a lot of ideas infiltrated early Christianity. Ideas like the immortality of the soul, which was a Greek idea, not from the Bible. The ideas of heaven and after death are Greek ideas, not from the Bible. But they were borrowed from the Greeks and made their way into Christianity. And this is, how it infiltrated Christianity early on, because that culture, that part of the world, was immersed in Greek thinking, Hellenism, Greek thought, and Greek culture. And the Greek culture, of course, is introduced by Alexander the Great, because he's a missionary. He wants everybody to adopt and believe Greek culture, Greek religion, Greek ideas. So they came to influence Judaism first, and then a century or two later, Christianity. See some of these ideas in Judaism to this day, too. Alexander was a missionary of Hellenism, and the way he put this into practice, of course, in 10 years, Alexander was an incredible military genius. In 10 years, he conquered the entirety of the known world of that time and created an empire that was the biggest in terms of square mileage of any empire in the history of the world. Bigger than Rome, bigger than the British Empire. In 10 years, as a young man, he won his first battle as a military commander at age 18. Think about that. So he is a military genius. So the way, and because he loved Greek culture so much, he thought the entire world would be better off if it was all Hellenistic, if it all worshiped the same Greek gods and goddesses, if it all adopted the same Greek culture and architecture and practices and religion and thinking and all of this. So the way he put this into practice, and the Romans later picked up and did the same thing, the Greek army and the Roman army later, as soldiers served out their term, they say they enlisted for 2 years or 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, as their enlistment ran out, the soldiers would be given land, may say 40, 50, 100 acres equivalent, something like that. They would be given land, they would be given a pension or a cash payment to buy or build a house, animals, things like that. And this is why or how a lot of the cities that Paul travels through and cities like these of the Decapolis we've been talking about, this is how a lot of these cities were founded. These military men would, in their enlistment, they would settle there, they would buy land or be given land rather, and these former military officers, soldiers, would be the heart and core of a city administration. They would be the mayor. They would be the engineers, the bridge builders, the building builders, the wall builders, the heart and core of a city administration. So this was a good system for them. It was a very organized system. So a lot of the cities that Paul travels through later are these former Greek colonies established by Alexander and his cities. That's why we have cities like biggest city in Egypt at the time was called what? Alexandria, named after Alexander. There are several Alexandrias that Alexander founded. So in these Greek cities, they would build four things. And I just got back from the feast in Greece. We didn't have much of a chance to talk about this over there, but if you know what you're looking for, where you go to any Greek city, any ancient Roman city, you see four things, very distinctive. First, they would build a gymnasium, which was a school. That's what it meant at that time. Today, gymnasium just means the basketball or the volleyball hall where those games are played. At that time, it just meant a school, and this is one from the city of Sardis in Asia Minor that I visited a number of years ago. And this was where they educated the mind and the body, because in Greek thinking, the mind and the body both needed to be trained and disciplined and so on. So the root word of gymnasium is the Greek word gymnos, G-Y-M-N-O-S, which means nude or naked. And a lot of the education in the schools involved being nude. Sports, for instance, were all done in the nude. As I say, you know, put a couple of hundred Greek teenage boys together in the nude. What can possibly go wrong? You know, so, yes, Emily.
Were these like public type of schools where everyone was sort of allowed, or was this more of like only the rich children?
It would have been, well, slaves would not have gone there, and slavery was very common. That was probably a fourth to a third of the population. But apart from that, everybody, all the boys, the women, it's not so clear exactly how they fit into that. We're just not sure. But the boys especially, yeah, teenage boys, yeah, they would go there. They would learn the famous Greek poets. They would learn the works of Homer. They would learn the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle and the great thinkers and so on. They would learn mathematics, algebra, military training, things like this. So this was very important at indoctrinating them with Hellenistic thought, Greek ideals, and so on. They would also, in these cities, build arenas for sports. We saw several of these on the trip to Greece, up at Delphi in particular. A stadium like this, the one we saw there, was for running, track and field, you might say. They would also build larger ones for chariot racing, as we see here. And sports were, again, also conducted in the nude. The ancient Olympic Games were done in the nude. So they would build gyms, they would build stadiums for sports. They would also build theaters for entertainment. And you see these all over the ancient world, very distinctive, very obvious when you see these because they're so big, so huge. Many of these would seat several thousand people. I think the biggest I've seen would seat probably 20 to 30,000 people. So this was very common, and they would have their entertainment there. And a lot of their entertainment, like entertainment today, is quite raunchy, quite vulgar, filthy, so on. And that also would proclaim the ideals of Greek culture and thought and thinking, just like TV and movies brainwash people today, and music. Alexander knew this, so they would use this to instill Greek values and Greek cultures. And the fourth thing they would build after the stadiums, school stadiums, theaters, is temples to their gods and goddesses. So you see these all over the Greco-Roman world. So religion also at that day often involved temple prostitution. And the way they worshiped their gods, going back to Old Testament times, this wasn't new with the Greeks, but we find reference to it throughout the Old Testament. This is one reason why God so detested the idolatry, is it often involved ritual prostitution. To worship the gods, you would go to a temple and you would have sex with a priest or a priestess, and you would pay money for an offering, or you would give an offering there, and that was the way you worshiped the gods at that time. And again, this is why God detested it, but this carries over into the New Testament. Cities like Ephesus, the great temple of Diana at Ephesus, and Paul stays for a couple of years there in Ephesus. And it was a center of, the temple was a center of prostitution for the worship of Diana, the Greek goddess there. So this was very common in the ancient world, and this is why God detests it. But with these four things, Alexander transformed the worlds that he conquered. And these are the four tools he used for instilling Greek thought and idea in people. And the Romans saw a good thing, so they continued the same practice. You see the same four things in the Roman cities that Paul encounters. And if you think about it, what dominates our culture today? Where do people get their thinking from? The same four things. The schools that are used to indoctrinate students, that there is no God. You all came from evolution, from a mindless, purposeless process that's random and by chance. Can't believe the Bible. It's just a book of fantasies and so on. So schools are used to indoctrinate people in anti-God thinking today. Who are our heroes in today's culture? Where do they come from? Sports and entertainment. Sports and entertainment. The Jewish culture, we've talked about, the greatest goal for a young Jewish teenager, young man, would be to become a great rabbi. In our culture today, they wanted to become people who were students of God's word, teachers of God's word. Now, people want to be a sports hero. They want to be a rock star or a rapper, something like that. Totally distorted values that are of no lasting value or meaning or purpose, ultimately in the long run. And, of course, religion is another tool that Satan has used for thousands of years to spread false ideas. So Satan, you might say, well, Alexander didn't originate all of these. A lot of the concepts go back earlier than that. But he really perfected the system by making it a systematic way of instilling that culture, those ideals, in the lives of all the citizens. The Romans picked up on it and used it, and it's continued right down to our day today. Very little has changed there. And in the Jewish culture of that day, some of those people were attracted to that. So they were drawn to that humanistic culture, that humanistic lifestyle and mindset. And that is a battle that goes on among our young people today, among you guys. What you have to deal with there, because Satan makes it very alluring, very exciting, very enticing there. But the question boils down to, which God are you going to follow? Are you going to follow the God of the Bible? You're going to follow the God of this world, the God of this age? And the philosophy of, if it feels good, do it, and the route of self-gratification and so on. Or will you follow the true God of the Bible? It's the same battle that was waged back in that day. Let's see, let me take just another minute or two here to conclude this thought. Again, the gymnasium we talked about was a place to be naked. Students went to school naked. They exercised. They did their sports naked. And in Greek thinking, this was perfectly normal because they didn't necessarily worship the human body, but they thought the human body was the ideal. And this is why so much Greek sculpture that you see, the people are naked in there. The body was the perfection of beauty and art and so on. So that's why so many of their statues are naked. And of course, in the Greek temples, as we mentioned, prostitution was very, very common. Female prostitutes, male prostitutes, men with women, women with men with men, whatever you wanted, you could go to the temple and get your desires satisfied there. And that was the whole worldview of Hellenism. Again, now what does this have to do? Yeah, let's bring it home here. What does it have to do with Galilee and what we see in the Gospels? Well, this was part of the culture that Jesus isn't immersed in, but at times he encounters, at times he rubs shoulders with it. For instance, when we see things in the Gospels like Jesus, like a bunch of demons entering a herd of 2,000 pigs, and the pigs run down the hillside and drown in the Sea of Galilee, people wonder, why are Jewish farmers raising 2,000 pigs? Well, they're not. This is from the Decapolis area, which is Greek, which is pagan. And they're raising pigs there. Why 2,000? Well, probably because those pigs are going to be used as sacrifices at the temples to the Greek and Roman gods. And it's just over on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, not more than 10 miles from Capernaum. They're doing this. You see things like the parable of the prodigal son who runs away, spends his inheritance on what? On prostitutes, on wild living, going to Las Vegas and blowing it all. And he ends up doing what? Ends up feeding the pigs. That's not taking place, well, it is taking place in Galilee, but it's not in the Jewish areas. It's across the other side in the Decapolis area where they're raising a lot of pigs because they're pagans over there. They're Greco-Roman pagans, and that's their thinking there. And if we don't understand this cultural and historical background, we can be puzzled and confused by this. So, here's another illustration of them bringing pigs to be sacrificed. One more quick thing here I want to bring out. When Jesus tells the parable of the prodigal son, of a young man who takes his father's inheritance and blows it all, he goes into what is called a far country in the Gospels. Actually, a far country was a Jewish term for the area of the Decapolis on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Here's roughly from Capernaum looking across at the cities of the Decapolis, Golan Heights today, but the cities of the Decapolis are over there. It's not far at all. It's less than 10 miles or so to get over there. But religiously and culturally, it might as well have been in a different universe. So the young man's father could look across in the parable and see he knows where his son is. And that's part of the heartbreaking aspect of the story. The father knows where his son is, and he's a good Jewish father, brought up his sons to be good Jewish boys, to walk in the law and to love the Lord their God and so on. And the son blows his inheritance on wild living and prostitutes. And that is the Greek culture that was so appealing to the son that he chose that way over God's way. And he ends up, of course, feeding the pigs there. And when we understand this background of this parable, it gives an added dimension to Jesus Christ's teaching because we can better understand then the hurt and the anguish and the pain of the father because his good Jewish boy has chosen to go the Greco-Roman pagan route for his life, and he's rejected everything the father tried to teach him about obeying God. And in the parable, who is the father? It's God the Father. And the parable, who are we? Who's the son? It's us. It's us. It's we're the ones who reject God. And in the end, what happens? The father rejoices because the wayward son comes to his senses and returns to the father. And the father all along has known where the son is and what he's doing. And that makes the story all the more profound about how deeply God loves us and wants to forgive us and wants us to come to him after having rejected him. So it's all the more profound when we understand the background there. So this is, again, why it's important to understand the geography and the background, the historical and cultural background of these areas. We'd miss a lot of the story if we don't understand these things. So.